Welcome to the special session of Crop Production Week. Crop Production Week is made possible by having a lot of sponsors that help pay some of the umbrella costs of bringing all of the groups together for this week. So on the slide, we have all of the Crop Production Week sponsors. Bayer Crop Science, Canterra Seeds, Farm Credit Canada is a new sponsor this year, Prairie West Terminal, Ray Glen Commodities also a new sponsor this year, Redhead Equipment, Saskatchewan Ministry of Agriculture that gives us great support, Saskatchewan Municipal Hail Insurance, and the Western Producer. Without the support of sponsors, the events at Crop Week would be much more difficult to accomplish. Can we have a round of applause for all of our sponsors? Really appreciate it. So we haven't exactly got a normal Saskatchewan winter to show our Aussie friend here. I know he was hoping for 4 feet of snow and minus 30 so he could tell stories about this over a beer with his friends back home. But let's give him a nice, warm Canadian welcome, Jeff Honey of Grain Trade Australia. Jeff, all yours.
Thanks very much, Kevin, and thanks for the warm welcome. It's great to be here, and it's a great event that you put together. We have nothing like this in Australia. We have various conferences, etc., around the nation, but nothing quite like Crop Production Week. So well done. And the other thing that really is very, very impressive is the fact that all the commodities get together and recognise that they need to work together on a lot of common issues, and it's for the common good. So that's well done on that to all the organising committee and everybody associated with the event. One of the things that I do wanted to speak to you this evening about is what are the similarities, perhaps, but in particular, what are the experiences? What are the experiences from that we can take it that you may want to take out of Australia and with the experience of the Australian deregulation of the export wheat market in Australia? One of the experiences I can't share with you though is minus 15 degrees centigrade. 4 or 5 days ago, I was down the beach with my kids. And so it was quite a different environment to what we have here. And I think I'd probably have to live through a winter here to really get a feel for what it would be like. And I can't even fathom that. The only way I can sort of keep in shape these days, being sort of pretty well desk-bound, is get on a push bike and do a few Ks in the morning. And I can't imagine doing that in the winter here with minus 15, then a wind chill on top of that. But having said that, I think the greater deterrent would be the sight of those pickups out in the car park. I think a lot of the pickup drivers that I see out there, they sort of tend to look at a cyclist and think there's potential roadkill. Anyway, let's hook into this and see how we go. Anyway, look, what are we going to do about today? I'll just do 30 seconds on GTA, Grain Trade Australia, where we are. Kevin asked to make sure that we put in some information in relation to production and the markets and the structural aspects of the Australian industry, because it's very, very easy to look at the Australian industry and some people have and said, well, Australia deregulated, Canada's deregulating, so therefore we can do a one-for-one, we can learn where did they go wrong, what did they do well, etc. There may be some things you can pick up from Australia, there's certainly other things that you can't. It's not a one, but what I will say is it's certainly not a one-for-one. A little bit of the history of AWB and then the Oil for Food Program inquiry, and then the important parts. What were the outcomes? The deregulation of the export wheat markets in terms of the production sector, the trade, with the establishment of Wheat Quality Australia, and there's still some unresolved issues which I'm more than prepared to share with you. And also, just on balance, is it a tick or a cross? Has it been a success or has it been some issues to contend with? So, just in terms of just who GTA is, we're a trade association, industry driven and managed. Membership goes from the production sector farming organisations, there's a number of those, right through to end users, domestic exporters, storage and handling operators all and traders all up and down the chain. Major banks are members. The solicitors and accountants are members of the Australian Stock Exchange because they run the futures, the wheat futures contracts. They are also members as well. So certainly good solid membership all up and down. We don't get any government funding and that's by design rather than anything else. What do? We put out the grain standards. The Commission does the wheat standards here. We put out the standards in Australia for all grains, wheat, barley, sorghum. The birdseed standards, pulses, are put out by Pulse Australia, and the oilseeds are put out by the Australian Oilseeds Federation. And then we publish them all. So the grain standards that are used right across the nation are put out by ourselves. We put out templates on a number of different contracts, grower contracts, trade contracts, container contracts, FOB contracts, freight contracts, storage and handling agreements, etc., that people pick up and use and accordingly. And we also, if there is an issue, we run an arbitration process. And the whole process works to the extent where we run about 4 or 5 arbitrations a year. So it works extremely well. The commercial processes work extremely well. We also have a very, very solid professional development program and industry advocacy to the federal government. Not on a we don't go along to state governments and start talking to them about their rail lines or whatever, but we certainly talk about trade and market access issues in relation to international trade. A little bit just on the rainfall map of Australia. I don't know how this is going to go. Just the wheat growing areas of Australia and the grain growing areas of Australia. And last year was just an unbelievable year for Australia. We had fantastic rain, and in fact it was during November and December, it started in December of 2010 and went into January of 2011. We had a huge rain event which really did enormous damage to the Australian crop, which was being taken off at that time. But what it did do, the positive side obviously was put an enormous amount of moisture into the ground at the same time. And it was right across Australia. And it's very, very rare to get a rain event that was right across Australia. Normally you'll get the East Coast gets it and the West Coast misses out, or vice versa. What I wanted to point out, and I don't know if the pointer can see it, and I'll do it on the other side in a minute, but the grain growing areas essentially are in that between 600 and 900 mil range in that grain, and they just follow all the way down into Victoria, up into South Australia and the west coast of South Australia, and then they go over to the eastern states, sort of from Esperance, you sort of draw a line across up to Geraldton, Esperance through to Geraldton for the wheat growing area. So I'll do it over here, sort of in this area. My hand isn't shaking that much, it's just the pointer. And then up into South Australia in here, and then Esperance through to Geraldton. So they're the wheat growing areas. What are the sorts of grains that are being grown? And you can sort of see that, and sort of as a general comment, the higher protein grains, the Australian prime hards, APH varieties, they are grown in the more northern areas, in Queensland down into northern New South Wales, and then you get into the softer or lower protein grades that are grown in New South Wales, and then all the way through South Australia into Western Australia as well. So the higher proteins in the northern areas. And the other interesting thing in there is I had a question just before we came in here about summer crops. Because wheat is a winter crop in Australia, and that's because we get the rainfall in the winter period. But there is some summer cropping, and that is in essentially the same areas where the prime hard wheat is grown as well. And so you would get farmers up there, they would probably typically would be two-thirds of their production in any one year would be wheat, and then they might put a sorghum crop in for the other third in a rotation. But that would be in Queensland, northern New South Wales. Whoops. Okay, so that's where the grain's grown and the type of grain. What I want to do now is just the structural aspects of the Australian market, and this is particularly important if you're just looking at trying to make some sort of comparison between Australia and Canada. We'll just start up in Queensland, and Queensland sort of typically, and these are the current harvest that is almost completed. The numbers aren't out, but I'm expecting that this year's harvest is going to be slightly better than the previous year. So if you wanted to sort of try and extrapolate some numbers, you could just add a little bit to all of these numbers that I'm just about to put up. But Queensland, you're looking at about sort of 1.5 million tonnes of wheat production, but there's an enormous of that wheat production, hardly any of it goes to export. The vast majority of it, as you can see, goes into the domestic market, not so much for human consumption, flour mills, etc., but very, very heavy use within the intensive livestock industries and feedlots in particular in Queensland. Feedlots and piggeries. Similar sort of situation in New South Wales, second biggest wheat producing state, sort of 6.5 million, 7 million tonnes of wheat. And we're looking at a domestic market there of about 2, so there's export capacity there that that we certainly had last year. And I would say that particularly last year, the vast majority of that export capacity or excess would have been feed, not any high protein wheats. It would have been feed because the last year's crop just got so badly washed out in New South Wales. Down in Victoria, similar sort of situation. We've got production there and about half of the production is going into the domestic market. The point I want to make is that within Queensland, New South Wales and Victoria, a very, very strong domestic market that growers have been able to sell into. So at any point in time, they could go AWB and put it into the pool, or they could go to the domestic market. They had the choice. You get over into South Australia, completely different issue in South Australia. Very, very solid production, and we're looking at sort of 4 or 5 million tonnes. However, there's hardly any on the domestic market. So once again, South Australian growers, when it came to selling wheat, well, there was essentially no choice. It was AWB. And once again, the other point that you need to read in there is that there was no choice, at the same time, they weren't developing marketing skills, whereas the marketing skills were certainly being developed by the eastern states growers. Western Australia, it's even worse. There's no domestic market. A couple of chooks around Perth and that's about it. When you see the graph there, and if you're at the back of the room, you may not see the number. Last year, 9 million tonnes. Western Australia is our biggest wheat producing state, and in total terms, and it gives us about 60% year on year. If you sort of average it out, it gives us about 60% of our exports because there's no domestic market. Okay, we also have the biggest farms in Western Australia, and it really is a case of it's not 80-20, it's about 70-30. 70% of the production comes from about 30% of the growers. They are just massive farms. And then, you look at from an Australian perspective, out of a total production there, 25, 26 million tonnes, you're looking at about 6 million tonnes domestic market. And that just puts it in different perspective. Western Australia leads in terms of production, followed by New South Wales, South Australia, Victoria, and then Queensland. I was born in Tasmania, and I always get an inferiority complex because there's no wheat industry there. Just in terms of volumes, that just sort of highlights once again the reliance that we have as a nation on Western Australia for exports in terms of grain coming out of Australia. Okay, just in terms of capacity, we have a plethora. We have overcapacity in terms of storage capacities within Australia. We've got, actually, there was one, I wonder if I can go back. There was one point that I did miss. Just in terms of, and that was port ownership, and I put it on there as a reminder as a reminder for myself. The eastern states of Australia, Queensland, New South Wales and Victoria, all the port facilities, bar a small facility in Melbourne, but all the port facilities are owned by one company, GrainCorp. All the port facilities in South Australia, I'm talking about the export port facilities for bulk grain, all the export facilities in South Australia are owned by one company, a company that you're very, very well aware of, and that's Viterra. In Western Australia, all the port facilities are owned by one organisation, CBH. CBH used to stand for Cooperative Bulk Handling. It now just stands for CBH, but it is still a co-op. It is a grower co-op. And so all of that production in Western Australia is handled by CBH. So in essence, there's just three organisations that handle and have the capacity to ship grain through their own terminals. That doesn't mean they're the only people who ship grain through their terminals, but they are the ones who own the terminals. So when you look at storage and handling capacities, for instance, on that top line there, GrainCorp, they have 270 storage or elevations in the country through Queensland, New South Wales, Victoria. If you went back about 10 years, that number was probably 1,000. But those numbers are continually being reduced. They've got a capacity, total capacity of 20 million tonnes. This year, all crop, they will take in about 11. So there's excess capacity there with GrainCorp. Similar sort of story with CBH and Viterra. The Cargill AWB did have four or five sites, actually 22 sites, more than a couple. It's not known how many tonnes that they would intake, but I would imagine those sites were put in places where there was a big drawing capacity. I wouldn't be surprised if there's 3 million tonnes in those sites at the moment. But the other interesting thing, which I must admit really didn't hit me between the eyes until I started doing a little bit of work to put this presentation together, but the Australian Bureau of Statistics estimates that there's about 15 million tonnes of on-farm storage as well. And that's particularly centred on the eastern states. And once again, go back, why is it centred in the eastern states? Because growers want to hold on to their grain because they can put it into the domestic market, sell it to a dairy farmer, a local feed mill, whatever it may be. It gives them that opportunity to mix and match their marketing their marketing plans. So we're looking at total capacity of just under 70 million tonnes. But intake this year, which is going to be a record, will probably be about 35, 36, perhaps 37. So lots of storage. Don't read. I hate these sort of slides where there's a plethora of names and whatever. I put this up just to, once again, what has been the transition. Back in 1985, every state had its own marketing board, its barley board, its sorghum board where sorghum was grown. It had its own handling authority, and they were all state-run and state-owned. They'd been paid for by growers through levies, etc., but the various states owned them. Beginning in the early 90s, the states started to say, just individually, what are we doing in the grain business? We don't know anything about running a grain handling authority. We don't know anything about running an oat marketing board. We're out of here. So what they did is they started to privatise, and they looked to grower organisations to take these particular whether they be, you know, the barley marketing boards or the handling authorities on. And for instance, that first one there up the, I'll just sort of point, there's an organisation up there, GrainCorp at the top, and over here, GrainCorp, that's on the eastern states. They took ownership of the port facilities and the various marketing boards. And you can see that over that last 20-year period, they've just kept collapsing and collapsing to the point where we now have only about five or six major storage operators who are also in the trading game as well. GrainCorp, Viterra, CBH, Cargill. Agrium is another name that would be familiar to you. Agrium actually bought AWB from the AWB shareholders and then sold the grain business to Cargill. But they've retained the Rural Services Division, and it trades under the previous name of Landmark, and Elders. And then there was an alignment between Elders and Topfa. So what you've seen is a continual consolidation in the Australian grains industry. So a little bit about AWB. Created in 1915 as a result of the First World War, and then it was disbanded, and it was just to put some sort of marketing system in place. Second World War came along, exactly the same thing happened, but during the war they put in place a stabilisation fund. GMP stands for Guaranteed Minimum Price. Ripper, what a great way to farm, having a guaranteed minimum price. The National Party, or the Country Party as it was then, was in power with the Liberal government, and after the war they said, let's keep this, this is too good, the growers love it. And they also put in, well, what they did was they put into law, and they called it the Wheat Industry Stabilisation Act. That went along quite happily until 1988, and the federal government really upset the apple cart here. The Industries Assistance Commission. Industries Assistance Commission was in essence put in place by the federal government to look at what is the assistance that the federal government is giving to various commodities, industry groups, sectors, etc. And does this assistance lead to competition within these various sectors? It wasn't set up for the grains industry per se. Textiles, footwear manufacturers, you know, railways, you name it, electricity, they all came under the pump. And anyway, one of the things that came out of the Industries Assistance Commission was the fact that they started to look at In 1988, we had a situation where AWB controlled the domestic market and also the export market. So in other words, you had a grower in New South Wales could not sell their grain, their wheat, to somebody in Queensland. Now, that is in direct contravention of one of the major fundamentals aspects of our constitution. So there was literally constitutional challenges by growers. I should be allowed to to sell my wheat across the state boundary, because it says in the Constitution there should be free and unfettered access and trade amongst the states. And so coming out of this in 1989, there was various outcomes came out. There was firstly, the Industries Assistance Commission said, why should the Australian taxpayer guarantee wheat growers a guaranteed minimum price or underwrite it? And the other thing is, they said, well, wait a second, why is the Australian taxpayer also underwriting the loans that AWB or the Australian Wheat Board are taking out to fund their pool payment system? So that is not that's nothing to do with the taxpayers. That's something that if the wheat growers want that and they feel so heavily about it and feel so strongly about it, they should fund it. And then the other thing was, this is this constitutional thing, the domestic wheat market was deregulated in 1989. So importantly, the thing that I want to point you to is point number two, and that is the Wheat Industry Fund was created. And so that was a levy on all first-hand receivables of grain that went to AWB. And that was started in 1989, and it went for another 10 years. So the important point there, let's sort of go back, the domestic wheat market was deregulated. So who did that really affect? It really only had any effect whatsoever in terms of wheat growers on Queensland, New South Wales and the Victorian growers, because there was a domestic market. The South Australians and Western Australians, they could just whistle Dixie. Who could, you know, like, they were just left out. They did not have any opportunity to do anything else with their wheat other than put it to the Australian Wheat Board, as it was. And the other thing about it is, if there was a drought on the eastern states, the Western Australians and South Australians carried the full weight of paying the underwriting fee of conducting the pool operations, instead of it being, you know, spread right across the nation. And so a lot of, particularly the Western Australians, you know, growers were particularly, you know, antsy about that. In 1991, the Grains Council of Australia, was the peak grain grower organisation within Australia. In 1991, if the federal government wanted to speak to the grains industry, they made two phone calls, one to the Grains Council of Australia and the other to AWB. In 1991, the only words that I can use to describe these people is there was inspired leadership by the CEO at that particular point in time and the directors of the Grains Council of Australia. And they recognised the need that they wanted to control the future. They didn't want to wake up one morning and find that the rug had been pulled from under their feet and certain things had happened to AWB which were contrary to the best interests of the Australian wheat grower as they saw it. And they had real concerns. They recognised that AWB or the single desk, that whole policy was not consistent with national competition policy that was being introduced by the government, and this came out of the Industries Assistance Commission reports. So it wasn't a wheat, it wasn't something that focused just on wheat, it focused on textiles, as I was saying, on all of those sorts of things, and why should certain segments of industry get preferential treatment. And they recognised that the single desk was going to come under threat because of that. They also recognised that there was going to be trade negotiations, and at that point in time, Uruguay was on, so WTO was going to, you know, the single desk was going to come under pressure from there. And they also recognised that because the government had already flagged it, that they were going to terminate the government guarantee on the borrowings. And once again, the government guarantee on borrowings, that comes back to where that wheat industry fund came from. So they said, OK, look, we want to take ownership of this. And they got out in the hustings and they just said, AWB needs to be restructured, and it needs to be restructured now. We can't wait until something happens in the future. So during that period up to 97, there was ongoing deliberations to privatise AWB and to put it into some sort of corporate entity. So, you know, the fact that the Australian wheat market was deregulated, the export wheat market was deregulated in 2008, wasn't something that just happened in 2008. That's what I want to get across. So in 98, the Australian Wheat Board became the Australian Wheat Board Limited. In 99, AWB came under grower control on the 1st of July, and they took control of the $600 million from the Wheat Industry Fund that had been collected, and that was held by the government under trust, and that was handed over to AWB. So they are now in a corporate entity, and they have a balance sheet and they have cash. They've got $600 million in cash in 1999. So that's not a bad little, you know, something to have in your back pocket. In 2001, AWB Limited goes public. In 2001, I could have bought shares in AWB Limited. I don't farm any country. I don't have an interest in a farming operation, but I could have bought shares. They were traded on the Australian Stock Exchange. And AWB also announced then that they were going to develop into a vertically integrated agribusiness. So they've got a balance sheet, they're a corporate entity, they're shares, they're a publicly listed company. And then in 2006, so 2001, everything's going along as far as AWB's concerned, going along swimmingly, and then in 2006, I suspect it was actually, not trying to point fingers too much, somebody in Canada raised the alarm, or put their hand up, because I know there was a lot of international traders were sort of putting their hands up and scratching their heads, saying, how is it that AWB can get product into Iraq at numbers, at rates higher than, you know, than we can get it in, and they keep getting the business? Something is going on. The UN looked into it. They said, yes, something has been going on. There's inconsistencies here. And they fingered a couple of Australian companies amongst a number of international companies. But there was a couple of international Australian companies that they fingered, of which AWB made up about 95% of the financial worth. And we had the inquiry into certain Australian companies in relation to the Oil for Food program, the coal inquiry in Australia. The other thing that you need to put into perspective, in 2005, we had as the Prime Minister, John Howard, Liberal Party, in absolutely lockstep, and I'm not making a political statement here, it's a matter of fact, he was in lockstep with George Bush. We'd been in Iraq from day one, we had ground forces, Air Force, Navy, the whole lot there, and there's this Australian company that's been breaking the rules and breaking the sanctions. It's not a good look, incredibly embarrassing at a political level, and as a nation, incredibly embarrassing. So they established the coal inquiry, but the government, as politicians only do so well, they set up the terms of reference to focus entirely on AWB and these other organisations, but for our purposes, it's, you know, as I was saying, AWB takes up 95% of it. And the terms of inquiry were such that they could really only look at the companies. They were not given the opportunity to really quiz the government and what the government knew about the Food for All program. So we just had a couple of cartoons here, and that's our Prime Minister. He's got, well, Prime Minister at the time, fairly short fellow, but he has enormous eyebrows, and he just, and I love this broad brush, brilliant whitewash. So the he did manage to keep the government out of the inquiry. And at the same time, we found weapons of mass destruction all over the place. And so we put our ground forces, you know, on day one into Iraq. But when it came with these masses of emails and paper that absolutely just had the government's hands all over them, of course we couldn't see anything about any evidence of AWB wheat contract kickbacks. And so he did a marvellous job in keeping the government out of it. But absolutely clobbered AWB. So, the beginning of the end, and this is probably a personal comment more than anything else, when you see the Prime Minister of the country being asked to give testimony and being asked about his involvement, it's not a good look. And as soon as you saw the Prime Minister being quizzed about his involvement, of whether he understood or knew anything about AWB, you knew AWB was gone. This was not, this isn't, we never got to the situation, is AWB good, bad or indifferent for grain growers? It was just, it could have been a washing machine manufacturer. If some company had set themselves up and brought this level of disrepute to them, to the nation and to the political party and to the government, and particularly at a time when we were so involved in Iraq and still have been, it was not a good look. So you just knew that AWB were gone. So he had called an inquiry. The Justice Cole handed down his report on the 27th of November 2006. In the intervening period, we'd had a change of government. I should have added too. And so we now have the Labor government in power. They got the report on the 27th of November, and they gave it an enormous amount of what's the word I'm looking for? They read it, obviously, and they pored over it and looked at, you know, pulled it apart. And they gave it about literally the weekend, and on the 1st of December, 3 days later, AWB was gone. So it was predetermined. There was no question about that. Everybody knew exactly where it was going to go. They lose their veto power, and that went to the minister. He held the power till 1 July 2008. Okay? So AWB was not government, and AWB and single desk and everything else, we never had a discussion about if it's good, bad or indifferent. The reason that AWB went, and it went so quickly, was because of the Oil for Food program. On 2007, we had the Wheat Export Authority replaced Export Wheat Commission, and that was the last harvest for AWB. This particular organisation was responsible for controlling export of bulk wheat from Australia. And they had to also monitor that performance of that 07-08 season, monitor the performance of AWB. And if anybody wants to see how AWB has been benchmarked against world prices for, you know, whether it's their hedging program or other activities, I'd refer you to the grower report that was put out for 07-08 and let you peruse that at your own in your own time. Suffice to say, it was less than flattering on AWB. They also administered the non-bulk wheat quality assurance program for containers going out of Australia. So that's how we got to where we got in relation to the deregulation of the export wheat market. One of the things that the minister did was, and we've got a Labor minister now, so you could say left-wing politics. One of the things that they were very, very mindful of was that they were not going to be put in a place where they could be accused of not going through due process or due consultation. So one of the things is they put a wheat industry expert group together. You know what they say about experts, drip under pressure. I had the pleasure of being one of the so-called experts. Industry development functions. They looked at one of the things that the pro-regulation lobby put forward was, wait a second, AWB does all these industry good functions. They do this R&D, the wheat variety classification, the receival standards, the information, crop shaping, all of these sorts of things. And the wheat industry expert group was tasked with, are these good, bad or indifferent? Are they things that the commercial sector will or will not pick up? Are there things that we need to catch if they fall through the floor? This is back in April 2008, and the report that came out. And once again, this particular process, there was drafts put out. People were asked to put submissions in and comment. And the report that came out just identified that in the vast majority of cases, commercial functions would pick up those particular activities. And I can stand here and look you in the face and say, that has occurred. So in 2008, draft legislation. It was very unusual for draft legislation to be put out for public, not just comment within the House of Representatives, but actually for public comment. And that's what has occurred on the 5th of March 2008. There was public comment sought on the draft legislation and an enormous amount of briefing sessions conducted right across Australia with everybody associated with who could have any sort of interest in the export of wheat from Australia. So that obviously the farm organisations were front and centre there, exporters who had port terminals and then also exporters who didn't have port terminals. And then the other thing was the Senate Standing Committee on Rural and Regional Affairs, they couldn't help themselves, they had to have their own inquiry as well. And once again, there was public comment sought there as well. And everything that came out of there was consistent. Then in 2008, in 29th of May 2008, the Minister went to the House and started up and said, this bill gives growers the right to choose which exporter they use. After all, it is their wheat. And I just sort of remind you, this is coming from a left-wing politician. So it was all quite contrary in some respects. And the major reforms, there was going to be Wheat Exports Australia, was going to administer a wheat export accreditation scheme. So in other words, to export wheat out of Australia, you had to pass certain tests. It wasn't just open slather. There was tests that had to be won, and one of them was that you had to be a fit and proper company. Now, you couldn't be an individual. You had to be a company or a corporation or a cooperative. There's a subtle legal issue there which escapes me. But you had to be a fit and proper company. So one of the major things they looked at is they obviously looked at the financial ability of the organisation to fund a program. So you had to put the traders had to put what they anticipated to ship in the coming year, and they had to be able to show a financial ability to fund that shipping program. And the other thing was, if you were a grain exporter, but you also owned a port facility, you had to provide access to other exporters. If I can use an analogy, Sydney Airport is owned by Macquarie Infrastructure. But Macquarie Infrastructure just can't say, Air Canada, we don't want you here. We only give access to Sydney Airport to Qantas, for instance. The Australian Consumer and Competition Commission and various legislation ensures that that cannot happen. Macquarie Infrastructure has to give free and unfettered, on sound commercial basis, access to Sydney Airport to anybody who wants to fly into Sydney Airport. They just can't pick. They just can't cherry pick who they want to do. And in exactly the same way, that has occurred with the port terminals within Australia. We've got three port terminal operators, but they have to give access to. There's 25 accredited exporters of wheat, so those three port terminal operators have to give access to any of those 25 exporters. And there's a process, which I won't go through tonight because we'd still be here tomorrow morning going through it, but it is a process that they have to go through. And once again, if anybody wants to take up more of that information, it's all on a website and I can get that for you. And the other thing was, the new system was going to be reviewed by the Productivity Commission, a government body, and that particular report, and I'll come to it in a minute, that report was handed down and the recommendations taken to the Minister. The Wheat Marketing Bill also included funding, a grand total of about $9 million, $9.37 million. $1 million was given for information sessions for growers and customers, 2.5 for collection and publication of market data. Now, this is not daily data on where markets are doing or anything like that. It is exports out of Australia, it's production, you know, how much was APH, you know, historical data, the sort of data that was used to put some of those graphs that I put up earlier. And that's done by the Australian Bureau of Statistics. So they were funded to collect that data. Some seed funding for Wheat Exports Australia, $500,000 technical market support grants for new exporters, and $100,000 for ourselves. We put together a code of conduct, and that is now being rewritten this year significantly, and it will become a code of practice, and it will be behaviours that are expected of members of the Australian grains industry. The point that I want to make here more than anything else was $1.15 million for growers for information sessions. That comes out at about $35 per grower against the sort of money that was put into when the dairy industry and the sugar industry were deregulated. There was hundreds of millions of dollars went to restructuring those industries and was aimed fairly at the grower side of the grower sectors. So how come the Australian growers got a paltry $35 million? And it's very, very simple. You had two grower organisations at each other. One was in the corner that said regulation. The other was in the corner that said deregulation. They got into the middle like some punch-drunk fighters, slugged it out, and they both fell to the mat and died. There was no production sector organisation that went to the government with any sort of cohesive policy. No policy. Nothing. So the minister was just standing there saying, "Whoa, home run. We'll give them $1 million and move on." But if they'd gone, if there'd been, and the other thing that I really want to, and I go back to a point that I made earlier, as soon as you saw the Prime Minister in the witness stand, you knew AWB was gone. So no use arguing the point, it's good for growers, anything like that, AWB was gone. You should have become quite pragmatic, and this is what, you know, a lot of the trade was saying to the grower organisations, look, go to the government now with a plan and a wish list, and you'll get it. No, they want to keep slugging it out. Wheat Exports Australia. And just on that, I still, as a trade association, running a trade association, I have to interface with a number of different organisations. I know who to call if it's the flour millers, the stock feed manufacturers, the lot feeders, whatever. When it comes to the production sector, am I going to make 30 phone calls to various, you know, individual grower organisations in the various states? I need to go to one organisation, one or two organisations. And there's one there that's embryonic, and we are doing everything in our power to see that that one gets up. But boy, oh boy, they're still slugging it out in the trenches with those who are still in denial about deregulation. Australia will never go back to a regulated environment for wheat. when that bill came forward to the House, there was no debate. There was a couple of the Greens who, you know, voted against it, but it had bipartisan support from both sides of government. So we're never going to go there again. So get over it, guys. Move on. I get a bit hit up at times. Wheat Exports Australia conducted the bulk wheat export scheme. The funding for that, 22 cents a tonne, and only from grain or wheat that's exported in bulk. So they get in about $4 or $5 million a year to do that. Currently 25 accredited exporters. The purpose of the scheme, we've already mentioned about that, a fit and proper company. Importantly, the scheme does not. So more importantly is what it doesn't do, doesn't regulate shipments of wheat. That is still a commercial function. If you want to put wheat out of Australia and you don't own the port access, you have to come to a commercial arrangement with the port access provider. It doesn't give any guarantee the exporter will remain financially viable. Particularly as a grower, you need to still do your due diligence and deal with organisations you feel are financially capable of paying you under the payment terms of the contract that you have or the pool arrangements that you've entered into. And they don't regulate the quality, variety or grade specifications of wheat exported from Australia. So there's no government instrumentality that issues a certificate in relation to the quality of the wheat that's leaving Australia. There will be certain documentation put out by superintendence organisations, put out by GrainCorp, etc., that will guarantee that the wheat is such and such protein screenings, etc., but there is no final government involvement at that point. Apart from AQUIS, which is the Australian Quarantine Inspection Service, they put out the phytosanitary, which is for live insects principally, certificates, because there's a nil tolerance, as it is here, nil tolerance to live grain insects. Okay, so look, what are some of the outcomes? So we've seen some new entrants into the Australian industry, particularly international companies that either had a watching brief on Australia or were not in Australia at all. There's about three or four major ones that are now ramped up their activity. Bunge and Gavilon are two good examples of that. ADM also. And also we've now seen national companies that were doing a bit on that were quite active domestically and now doing international work as well. So accredited exporters, we had one, we've now got 25. Importantly, the container trade went from almost zero, 10 or 20 or 30,000 tonnes, not negligible amount of grain going out or wheat going out of Australia in containers. It's now in excess of 2 million tonnes. And that's going into niche markets. And that's because individual organisations, not so much the larger organisations, I'd say, but for small to medium operators, some of them may be only family businesses. They got out and they ferreted out markets, particularly through Asia. And Vietnam's a good example. There's plenty of mills there. They can't handle bulk, but they can handle five or six containers of wheat at a time. So there's 2 million tonnes of wheat that's now going out of Australia in the container trade, and that's been a real boon for the regional areas, the country areas of particularly the eastern states where most of this is happening, because the container packing is being done principally up country and then being taken to port in containers. The production and export program in 10-11 was a record production and export program in 10-11, and that's without Western Australia due to drought. And I'll sort of put that one up there. One of the things was, wait a second, if we're going to export wheat out of Australia, 3 or 4 years ago, the argument was we've only got one company that we have to deal with, that's AWB. Then all of a sudden we're going to have to deal with 25. It's going to go to hell in a handbasket sort of thing. Well, things like this just don't happen. We don't have an export shipping program unless there's commercial imperatives, and those commercial imperatives work. So, and once again, what we will see this coming year, we will see an even bigger shipping program because of the carryover and the production that's now being taken off the fields. Shift in export destinations. This has been a really interesting one. Typically, there was a very, very strong focus on the Middle East and then into Asia. But just graphically, that's where it's gone. AWB was focused on the Middle East. Once you opened it up, the companies that are now operating within the Australian market, they have very, very good contacts through Asia, and we just have a natural freight hedge particularly, or a freight advantage I should say, into countries like Indonesia. Indonesia takes about 3 million tonnes now. So we have that natural freight advantage. It's going to make it very, very hard for countries like Canada to get into those sorts of markets when we've got the freight advantage coming out, particularly out of Western Australia. Western Australian production is export orientated because there's no domestic market there. So that's going to go straight into the Middle East, straight into those Asian markets. The other thing I'd say is, thank heavens, we had that, that we'd opened up that market because the amount of feed grain that we had last year just swamped the domestic market and it had to go export. We had never exported feed grain in those sort of quantities before, and it was because of the links and the network that those new companies that are now operating in the Australian market have, that we're able to get feed grain into brand new markets through Asia and actually displaced feed grain that was coming out of Black Sea ports. So it's nice to get one on there. And then the other is the financial capacity of the industry was sound. Out of last year's harvest, everybody was paid and everything worked. There was no financial, there was no insolvencies. Contracts were honoured. The system worked extremely well. There was one notable exception, thank you, to that, and that's where a grower cooperative thought that they could cut out the middleman, sold $2 million worth of product to a fellow who operated above a fruit shop at Riverwood. I don't know Saskatoon, but I'm sure somewhere in Saskatoon there's a suburb like Riverwood, and this guy, sight unseen, they sold him $2 million, and payment terms were 30 days from when the ship leaves. Well, hello, come in, spinner. They waved goodbye to $2 million. I'll come up to it in a minute. The other thing is just in logistics, there's been new investment. Organisations are now buying trains and wagons, their own capacity, rather than relying on the infrastructure that's there. The Viterra Port of Adelaide Outer Harbour project has been completed. There's a proposed new export terminal for Newcastle and another one for Western Australia. Now you're going to say, well, why do we need that? They are proposed. Major companies with balance sheets are prepared to put these facilities in unless the current port operators play ball and give them, you know, free and at commercially sound rates access to their port facilities. But there's some big organisations that if it all gets too hard, they will just say, well, you know, take a running jump. We are going to put in our own port facilities. And then the other big one, as I already mentioned, private regional storage is often aligned to a container packing facility. We saw the establishment of Wheat Quality Australia, and that does the varietal classification process, something that was done by AWB. On AWB figures, it's a function that used to cost about between $1.5 to $2 million a year. It's now being done within a company jointly owned by the GRDC, Grains Research and Development Corporation, and ourselves, and it's costing about $650,000 to run that particular activity. Production sectors, just some general comments. What have been the impacts on growers? Just in terms of marketing, just some general comments to sort of start with. One of the things was there wasn't the recognition. You know, when you got your payment from AWB for the pool, it didn't highlight what the various charges were. They tended to be like you'd get a net figure. And then consequently, you've got producers, they're not conditioned to paying for advice. But that is changing. The other thing as far as within the production sector that is not well understood by many, many growers is this concept of the cost of carry. You know, if you put grain in your own storage on farm, there's the cost of the storage, there's the cost of the chemical application, and then also there's the opportunity cost or lost on the funds that could have been invested. So this is the cost of carry, and that concept is not well understood, and it needs to be, particularly where people are holding grain. It needs to come into the equation. So producers taking control of their marketing. There's been a number of establishment of marketing co-ops, and I would say in the main they've been very, very successful. Some of them, as I just mentioned, have been unsuccessful, but the ones that are doing it well are those that have said, okay, we have excellent production capabilities. We have a board that is focused on getting the dollars back to producers, but we don't have the skills to manage risk or the price risk associated with grain. We don't have the skills associated with the logistics of moving grain. So what they're doing is they're aligning themselves to a trading house. Okay? And there's a number of those marketing co-ops right through the nation that have been established. And there's also been the increased use on on-farm storage. And as I was saying, there's about 15 million tonnes of production that now can be stored on-farm. There have been some issues, principally with, we just call them silo bags, you know, the sausage bags, the ones with plastic. They are not, certainly in an Australian environment, they are not long anything, well, they're not even short-term. They're good for about 2 months in the Australian conditions, and after that they deteriorate to the point where trade will not take grain out of silo storage bags after the end of February. You know, and this is a December-January harvest. After the end of February, the vast majority of trade won't take grain out because of water egress, ingress, water getting in, and also weevils, etc. Marketing options, warehousing. This is something that has really sort of taken off. Keeping in mind that a big project, you know, so somewhere like Western Australia, for instance, where you don't have a lot of on-farm storage, the grain goes direct into the central storage system and likewise in other states. Whereas a lot of it used to go in, and if it was wheat, it just automatically went to the pool. There was no discussion entered into. What you're now finding is about 70% that's been delivered to the central storage or the operators during harvest, about 70% of it or a number like that, is just going into warehousing. They get free storage through to the end of January, so they might get 4 or 5 weeks. So they get free, you know, the grower will get free storage through to the end of January. And if they haven't done anything net by the end of January, come 1 February, they get charged a couple of dollars a tonne per month from then on. So about 70% just goes into warehousing. About 15% of it's going to be applied to contracts at harvest time, and about 15% is going to be applied to pools. And I'll have a little bit more to talk about in pools in a minute. So the thing about, particularly why is it that about 70% goes into warehousing, what the growers are essentially saying is, I want to get the grain in, I want it to get into the warehouse. Once I've done that, then I'll sit down and I'll work out which load I'm going to apply against which contract. And last year was a fantastic example of that. With multi-grade contracts, that's a contract where we have a base price and then we have premium discounts according to the grade. If it's a bit better, you get more. If it's a bit, you know, if it's a lower grade, you get less. And last year's rain event saw a lot of grain that would typically have been APH and, you know, high-grade grain, high-protein grains going feed. And the discount from the APW through to feed is typically about $40. Last year, because there was so much feed, the spread went out to about $100. So when people did the maths of it, those who had some higher grade grain, they sold that on the cash market, and then they applied the feed grain against the contract, and instead of getting a $100 discount, they're only getting a $40 discount because of the feed. So that's where the optimising loads. And I should say that the people who took an absolute hammering last year in terms of particularly multi-grade contracts in Australia was the trade, because they were anticipating certain levels of APH or premium wheats coming through and they just didn't get it. But of course they still had their international contracts that they had to honour. Another thing is, obviously, there's growers who just put it in there to hold on to price in hope of a higher price later on. And if you're going to be doing that, the other thing that needs to be taken in consideration is that cost to carry that needs to be considered. Pools, there's been a decline in activity. There was a decline in activity, particularly in the higher priced years. I would suspect that this year we're going to see more pool activity because we've got a softer market. So growers will be putting more into pools, but we'll sort of wait and see. But we have seen some innovations there. We've got a pre-commitment pool where instead of just committing at the time of harvest, people may be committing to the pool 2 or 3 months pre-harvest, and in that they might be picking up a premium of $10 or $15 or something, you know, of that per tonne. And that allows the company that's operating the pool to start putting their marketing program instead of having to wait until what's going to come in at harvest time. It gives them some idea. Are we looking down the barrel at a million tonnes, 2 million tonnes, whatever. And the other one, this has me a little bit perplexed, set sales over a period of time. It's a very, very simple one. And that's where, in one company in particular, and it's been very successful, they've just said, okay, Mr. and Mrs. Grower, you know, you've got 1,000 tonnes. We will sell equal portions of that over a period of time, and we'll just average it out, and you'll get the average. So, you know, do you want the period of time to be 2 months, 3 months, 6 months, whatever? So if somebody's got, nominates 5 months, and they sell, they've got 1,000 tonnes, 200 tonnes, you know, per month for 5 months, and then there's a management fee associated with this. I would sort of tend to think, well, that's something that, you know, a grower could do, but that particular one has been very, very successful. The other important thing is, and this is not something that is well understood, and please don't think that this applies in Canada as well. So see your lawyer. Certainly in Australia, when you deliver grain to a pool, the title in that grain changes hands to the pool operator. You don't get any money, but title in the grain changes hands, and that is the only way the pool operator can then start marketing the grain from then on. Okay? So if the pool operator became insolvent, you get in line with the other unsecured creditors. And that's an important thing, and it's something that we keep hammering the Australian growers with. And so once again, do your due diligence, do your business with organisations that are well understood, that have a balance sheet that you feel comfortable with. And if somebody's offering, you know, $10 above the market, well, yeah. Just jumping back to where Cheryl is, you know, she sort of tells a story. If it's 50 cents or a dollar above the market, take it. If it's $5 above the market, be cautious, but still don't take it. If it's $10 above the market, call the police. That's exactly where it is. If it's where people just keep getting caught out. But it's an important one. And for the last 10 years, when AWB became a publicly listed company, if it had become insolvent, the Australian government didn't stand behind it in any way, shape or form. And once again, that's something that is not well understood by Australian growers, even today. Other things that have occurred, contracts. There has been, you know, some movement here. The no fixed price is just, you know, where somebody puts, you know, grain in, and then they get a first payment, and then they're given typically sort of at some stage over the next 6 months at a point in time at which to fix that price, up to sort of anything up to 6 months. But by and large, Australian growers have gone back to pretty, I'm just using the term vanilla, very straightforward contracts. They had a flirtation with derivatives. Is this going to come up? One more clip. With derivative contracts, you know, that's contracts where you're using futures FX basis and mixing the three and into an equation and coming up with a set price. There was strong use of those particular products by growers. 3 years ago, once again, it turned into an absolute disaster year for these types of contracts on both sides, for the growers, particularly those growers who didn't have production, and we saw futures double between April and December, and also from the traders who were offering these contracts, because guess who had to pay the margin calls? And they were making the traders had to pay the margin calls on these contracts, and they were doing it without any security whatsoever. So after that year, all of the companies pulled these particular products. That's not to say some growers still aren't doing that sort of activity, but they're doing it in their own right. Whoops, one too many. So if there is a grower that wants to do something along those lines, wants to do it and not take a physical position or have to deliver grain, what they are doing it is via bank swaps, and that's where the banks, who already have some sort of charge over a grower, will offer them in Australian dollars what they're calling a swap, and so that's they'll sell to them, notionally sell so many tonnes at a particular value, and then at a set time, you know, the 30th of December, they will then take the opposite position as to where the market is on the futures exchange and foreign exchange on that particular day. So the banks are actually doing the trading, and the growers are just taking the positions. And so it's a cashless situation. Ancillary services, we've seen a real increase in the use of advisors, particularly by I was nearly going to say larger growers, but right through all sectors. When it comes to advisors, just a couple of the sorts of things, you know, if I was talking to a group of Australian growers, what I'd be saying to them is, you know, just be careful in terms of the advisors that you use. If they start talking to you about, we'll be able to pick a market, leave it with us and we'll get a price premium for you. If there's that sort of talk, yeah, we'll walk away. If they start talking to you about a marketing plan, what your budget is, what products you feel comfortable with, what prices do you need to make your budget, if there's that sort of discussion going on, that's the sort of discussion that you do need. But certainly none of this, you know, pick a market and we'll get a premium market. If you're going to do that, you're a speculator. And then the other one is, which is very fledgling, is online grain brokerage services, but a couple of thousand tonnes. It's very, very new and it's just not being taken up. The other one is, and this is more the banks and the bulk handlers, inventory financing for warehouse grain. So you'll get payment and then it's just a loan secured against the grain that you have in storage. But of course, you get the cash flow, but you're exposed to the market and there's this cost to carry comes in as well that you need to consider. Some contracting issues that, because we run an arbitration process, these are some of the issues that sort of come up, particularly on the production side. And one of the things that I keep getting hit about the ears about is I didn't sign the contract, therefore I don't have a contract. Well, a verbal contract by definition is a contract. A contract, and once again I'm talking from an Australian perspective, a contract, whether it's written or verbal, is a contract. Obviously, if it's a verbal contract, you then have to have a process in place to be able to prove that there was a conversation, because it's been done on the telephone, that there was a conversation and that there was agreement on offer acceptance, financial consideration, and there was the intention to reach a conclusion. The other thing is confirm everything in writing, keep a marketing day book, just don't commit it to memory, and worse still, if you think you can do your marketing in the car using a mobile phone, forget it. Those sort of things, throw the mobile phone away. If you're talking about marketing, unless you're in the office, you need to take those notes about what the discussion was and who it was with and the time of day, all those sorts of things. And the other thing is growers, they tend to sort of sit back and they just sort of wait for the trader to send the confirmation to them. Well, get off your ass and become proactive and get it back to the trader. And, you know, if you've done a contract on the phone, get that back to them and let them know that you are confirming that conversation that you've had. You're not sending through a contract, but you are confirming the contract that has been done. Contract confirmation was incorrect. If something does come through, attend to it immediately. If the number's wrong, if it says 645 instead of 656 or whatever it may be, attend to that immediately. Just don't say, oh, look, I'll get around to that in a couple of months' time. Too late. Contract amendments need to be in writing, particularly if you change your delivery periods. Confirm that in writing, and these only needs to be a handwritten fax. Ignorance is no defence. You can't get up and say, oh, I wouldn't have entered that contract if I'd known, you know, that I had to do this, that or the other. If you don't understand the contract that you're looking at getting involved with, don't go into it. Okay? You can't stand up. Ignorance is no defence. That's just a legal, you know, concept. Understand your rights, because you do have rights. It is a contract and it comes under contract law, but you've also got obligations as well. Read the contract. There's a lot of Australian growers, they might have a contract that's got a face value of $250,000 or $500,000. How many of them would buy an investment property in Sydney for $250,000 or $500,000 without getting their solicitor to look at it? Not many. I'm not saying that you have to read every contract, but you need to go through your contracts and understand. And if you don't understand, and the GTA contracts are written in plain English, and they're on the website if you want to have a look at them, the grower contracts. But if there's anything in there that you don't, you know, a grower doesn't understand, they need to make sure that they understand exactly what it is, what your rights are, because as the seller you do have rights, but you also have obligations. Read the contract. And the other thing that with our organisation, probably I don't know what the number is, but there would be only a handful of contracts that are done in Australia each year that are not done under GTA trade rules and grain standards, etc. And one of the, if there is a dispute, the dispute is automatically referred to the GTA arbitration process. And once again, that is something that is not well understood, although we keep pushing it. And it's not as though if it does go to arbitration and you are the respondent, you just can't say, oh, I'm not going to participate, and just completely ignore it, because an award will be handed down. If it's handed down and is not in your favour and you want to appeal it, you don't go along to the local district court in your local town or wherever it may be. And I don't know what the equivalent is in Saskatoon, but you go straight to the Supreme Court of New South Wales. Okay, straight to the top of the pecking order when it comes to courts to appeal and arbitration. So there's some of the sorts of things that growers really need, you know, within Australia, need, you know, really need to start to get their heads around and recognise when in terms of doing contracts. And in the main, they are doing it extremely well. We put a little booklet out. It's gone out to growers every year for the last 4 years, to every grower, and it's just, you know, once again, it's a guide to taking out contracts to supply grain. So we must be just about there. So some of the developing unresolved issues, trade capacity, shipping stems and associated issues. We've still got, there's still a little bit of angst there between people who want to export grain out of Australia and the port operators. It was, you know, it was significant 3 years ago, less so, you know, each year it's getting better and better. It's not because there is a deliberate attempt by one or either of the parties to make it as difficult as possible. It is just teething issues of organisations developing their own commercial processes because they have responsibilities to their shareholders, obviously, both of them. But it is getting better, and the fact that last year we had a record shipping program bears testimony to the fact that it does work. The production sector, the major thing there is national representation. It's just not there and it is critical. Generic promotion of Australian wheat. Wheat Quality Australia dipped its toe in the water in this area only just a couple of months ago and attended a trade show in Singapore. So I think you'll start to see that area start to develop more and more as industry recognise the benefit of the generic promotion of wheat, and Australian wheat in particular. Keeping in mind that probably only about 40% of the grain that goes out of Australia, the contracts that it goes out on specifically identify Australian origin. The vast majority of grain that goes out of Australia, the contracts are optional origin. So it's just that they can get the grain out of Australia more favourably than they can get it out of Canada or North America and wherever it may be. But having said that, you still do need that generic promotion of Australian wheat. The Productivity Commission, just in almost there, they handed down their report. They looked at all those things that the Wheat Industry Expert Group said should happen. They looked at the legislation and the port access issues, the accreditation schemes put in place by Wheat Exports Australia. They looked at all of that. They put out a very, very detailed report. Once again, this is on the website if anybody wants to trawl through it. A couple hundred pages there. But they came out with recommendations, and all the recommendations have been adopted by the government and will be in place, and that is Wheat Exports Australia and the Wheat Export Charge, that's going to be abolished as of the 30th of September 2012. The access test requirements to support open competition, this is the access test requirements for ports, will be in place until 2014, and then from 2014, that particular aspect of the Australian market, the interface between those who want to export and those who operate the ports, that aspect will be fully deregulated, but it will still come under the competition law administered by the Australian Consumer and Competition Commission. So, since the coal inquiry, what we've had to deal with. So we've had 06 to 08 were drought years, and certainly you would have been exporting a lot more grain than we did in those years. The new shipping arrangements came in and we weren't quite sure how they were going to operate. We had a record wheat crop last year and I suspect this year will be even bigger. However, one thing that we're not going to see this year is the downgrade that we got out of last year's wheat crop. We have had a record Aussie dollar, and that's not due to pressure on the dollar coming from the export of grain, but the export of minerals and minerals that are still going into China and in India. That's the one that's really putting the pressure on the Aussie dollar. And it's been above par for the best part of the last 12 months. We had a record shipping program 10-11 year, but the downside is the disintegration of production sector representation. So when you sort of put it all together, just on balance, you know, the commercial forces, you know, stepped up to the plate in terms of what's required to get wheat out of Australia, because that's what it was all about. Can we do it? And we did. The systems and the processes did perform and are improving, and what it's resulted in, an export system that has worked. Thank you.